Hello, everyone. I'm going to talk about drugs today. So I actually work at ECMC. I don't actually work at Roswell. I'm an oncology pharmacist. I work basically next to physicians and work with patients hand in hand. So part of my job is to understand how chemotherapy works, some of the side effects of chemotherapy, how that interplays with the patient, and figuring out side effects and how to get them through their therapies. What's really important to know, though, however, is how chemotherapy actually works. Why do these drugs do what they do? Why do we use them in cancer? So when I talk about chemotherapy and I teach our my pharmacy students and pretty much anyone else who comes in contact with me, it really is just biology 101. The idea of a cell cycle and what the cell cycle does and what cancer is in relation to the cell cycle is really what we're targeting when we look at chemotherapy. So what I say is that if you're able to understand this and figure out how it happens, details, you're able to develop drugs and therefore cause an effect in either slowing down the cancer or killing the cancer itself. So understanding really biology 101 is really all you need. So chemotherapy is a thing, the use of chemical agents to treat a disease. And that's a very vague and broad definition. So much so that in pharmacology, oftentimes the word chemotherapy actually means things that treat cancer and things that treat infectious disease. For me, and explaining it to others, especially with basic science backgrounds with microbiology, you talk about antibiotics, there's a lot of similarities between the two groups. And if you understand antibiotics, to some extent, we're targeting things that are different from ourselves, we're able to do something about it. So the word was originated in 1910 by Paul Ehrlich. Developed the first treatment of syphilis, and he also introduced this concept of magic bullet. And magic bullet means is basically we have a drug, it causes an effect, and the only effect that it causes is to its desired target. It does not cause any other issues. So that's really important to think about, because we're pretty far from the magic bullet at this point in time. And so, as I mentioned before, we talk about it in terms of infectious disease and cancer. So I know that you guys are all reading Emperor or reading or watching the video or whatever. So you know Goodman and Gilman here. In the pharmacy world, they're gods. They're one of our textbooks. And that's really important. On the other hand, you have this. This is Barry, Italy, where the nitrogen mustards were exploded into the harbor, causing myelosuppression and all that bad stuff. So nitrogen mustards in World War II were really taboo, and when Hitler was starting to lose the war, they were kind of worried that maybe he would start to use chemical warfare. So the Allies brought it in to Europe, and they sat in this harbor in Italy, and you get hit with a bomb, releases all this bad stuff in the air and into the water. Sailors that were exposed to these things were noted to have profound myelosuppression, and depleted lymph nodes, so really not good things. Parallel to this, Goodman and Gilman developed their drug in murine models. It's a nitrogen mustard, which we'll talk about. And they convinced a surgeon to treat one single patient with one drug. That one drug in that one single patient did have a response, and it was great. But they couldn't publish it because they were worried about keeping the secrets away from the Germans. And so that data was not published until 1946. So nitrogen mustards as a class, what they do is they alkylate the guanine, nucleotides and DNA cause an inhibition of cell division. So what does that mean? That basically means that you have your DNA double helix. These molecules come in, they bind to that double helix, preventing any sort of activity, either unwinding, uncoiling, etc. It stops it in its tracks. One of the things that's noted about these early therapies, including what Sidney Farber did in Boston, was that he was looking at folic acid. And folic acid was originally thought to maybe slow down cancer, but when he actually tested it, it actually accelerated cancer, which wasn't good. Antifolates, and in particular aminopterin, which was the drug that he used, was able to induce a response in childhood leukemic patients. So in both situations, we have a single drug and some sort of effect, but it was short-lived. So, and these patients relapsed and died, and that wasn't really good. But it was the start of something, and that's what's really important here, and that's kind of where we start off when we think about chemotherapy. So chemotherapy as a whole, as a class, we didn't really have a good grasp of what it actually did until the 1960s, 1970s. So that's kind of the preamble, the foreshadowing of what's to come. Let's talk a little bit more about concepts and some of the background information. And I'll draw a lot of parallels to infectious disease because I think that that's a really effective way to get the grasp of what we're talking about. So if we go back to bacteria and how mutations arise. So we think of Darwinism and we think that selective pressures ultimately influence natural selection, and so you have short giraffe that die, and you know the biology 101 pictures of what that looks like. But in that model then, it would be reasonable to expect when we have two groups of bacteria that we'd have similar number of colonies that would accumulate mutations, and they would be predictable. So what they, Lurie and Delbruck did here was is they took two groups of bacteria, two plates, exposed them to a bacteria, bacteria grew. They added a virus that would inhibit the growth of the bacteria and slow it down. And they said if it was due to natural selection alone, there would be equal populations in both groups of plates between them. So you counted, you know, groups, plates in group A, there would be two colonies, there'd be the same in group B. As it turns out, the number of resistant colonies varied significantly between plates. And these plates were due to a random mutation, so mutations that just randomly happened. That's really important because that's different from natural selection, because natural selection alone would just, the virus would select out the colonies and that would be it. But as it turns out, the mutations actually were random. And so this is what they looked at. So there were two models that were proposed that would have worked. One would have been the spontaneous mutations, and then the ones that are induced mutations. So this is Darwinism. This is what actually happened. So based on the number of plates, so this is a plate, this is a plate, this is a plate, this is a plate. You can see that the number of black colonies differed between plates instead of being the same between plates. So the randomness is actually important, and why am I mentioning this is that cells, good or bad, accumulate mutations. And this randomness of mutations is important when we consider chemotherapy, because it turns out when we look at our models and the idea of a single agent chemotherapy, we can actually have random mutations that make it resistant inherently to the chemotherapy. So that's important. Goldie Coleman came along, and this is a mathematical model. I'm not a mathematician, so there'll be no formulas or equations or anything like that. Don't worry about that. But it's important because it's the likelihood of developing somatic mutations that lead to drug resistance. So what they say is the probability of resistance of a drug is greater as the size of the tumor increases or the rate of division increases. So that means is that the more cell cycles and the bigger it is, the more likely it is to have a mutation. That mutation may be causing some drug resistance, and that's what it's really looking out for. And this can actually develop before a tumor is clinically detectable. And you know, the lower limit of detection is quite big when you think of a cancer cell. And we'll get to that in a little bit, too. So what Goldie and Coleman said was cancer is best treated by concomitant chemotherapeutic regimens. So the idea of chemo regimens comes out of this idea that we have mutations, they happen randomly. One drug, it may be a tumor, it might be resistant to one drug, and so that's why we have to treat it with multiple things. And then we get into this idea of different clones, and that's kind of where we are right now. So if we have a tumor here, this is a heterogeneous mix of genetics, you have these blue cells, which happen to be sensitive to chemotherapy. You kill those cells off, so they die with chemotherapy. What you're left with are the resistant clone. That resistant clone proliferates, and then therefore you have progression. So what we know so far is that tumors, first off, need to be sensitive. That's really important, and I didn't really cover that. But they need to be sensitive. Two, mutations happen randomly, and we sometimes have to use drugs in combination, therefore, to inhibit and get around that random mutation that accumulates. So this is cancer growth and dynamics. So it's really important to follow this when I'm looking at this slide. This dotted line that goes up, the slope is very rapid here. It eventually slows down as we get to here. So this is cancer cell growth. And we introduced this idea of growth fraction, which is really important. Growth fraction is the number of cancer cells that are dividing in the actual tumor itself. So the higher the number, the more cells dividing through the cycle, and therefore the higher the growth fraction. The growth fraction is actually quite high right in this area because, one, you're not competing for nutrients or blood supply, oxygenation. Those things are all important for the cancer to develop. So this is really, really rapid, and then it slows down as nutrients and blood supply kind of get divided up over a larger tumor. So, you know, obviously your nutrients and blood supply, you know, there is angiogenesis and microvascular formation, but overall there's still less to go around. And so growth fraction slows down in this portion of the curve. There's less to go around, and cells are less likely to be dividing. And that's really important. So at the same time as this growth curve, you have inherent resistance developing because of our mathematical models that are saying mutations happen, they happen randomly, and they happen as tumors grow in size and in speed. There's competition over nutrients, and therefore less cells are going through cell division. So you got that going on. The other thing that's really important to note about this curve is that when we think about fast-growing cells, there are other cells in the body that are also fast-growing. And so those are your bone marrow, your stem cells, your hair follicles, and your GI tract. So that's really important when you think about chemotherapy. And when we think about the original members of the chemotherapy class as a whole, a lot of the side effects are nausea and vomiting, hair loss, myelosuppression. So then that explains that. It's actually not until you get to the 10 to the 9th number of cells before you actually have the a detectable tumor. And this is a really tiny tumor. This is the size of a sugar cube. Which doesn't give you a lot of room here. These zigzag lines I'll talk about in a minute, but they represent treatment regimens. So there are several different types of chemotherapy regimens, and these are definitions, really, for the most part. And this is really important when we're talking about chemotherapy. So adjuvant chemotherapy is chemotherapy that's given after surgery. So the idea behind this is if you resect or remove the tumor, so take it out, you might have some residual disease that you can't necessarily see as the surgeon's eye. And that explains because we have all this room here before we can actually see it. And that's the reason for the adjuvant therapy. Neoadjuvant, neo is new. And if you like the Matrix, it's the guy. It's chemotherapy given before surgery. So the idea behind this is the opposite, where you're actually shrinking the tumor before surgery, hopefully making the surgery more successful, the quality of life intervention sort of thing. We have palliative chemotherapy, and you know that's a broad category, but this is really chemotherapy that's meant to improve symptoms and quality of life. And this is in gentler regimen. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have toxicities. Doesn't mean that the toxicities are not severe. But it's supposed to be kinder to the patient to some extent. And then there's the curative chemotherapy where this is more aggressive, this is more toxicities. So this is the same curve as before, except now we have these zigzag lines that I want to talk about. So if we look here, these peaks up here and up there, those represent doses of chemotherapy given. So you give a dose here, your growth fraction goes down here. Give a dose here, your growth fraction goes here. So the net movement is down. So you're constantly killing more cells than you're making. And that's the idea behind a curative regimen. That's essentially what it's doing. This up here, and that's chemotherapy regimen B. Chemotherapy regimen A is what we call a palliative regimen. So basically, we're taking the time that it goes from here, so that's time, here, time, it's longer, and that's palliation. Now there's this adjuvant regimen. Adjuvant regimens is, and it's actually better to look at this one, is this line here. So you have a surgery, the surgery removes, and when they do the surgery, they look in under a microscope, make sure that what they have are negative margins. And what that means is, you know, in kindergarten you had the dotted lines, you cut around circles and squares. Surgeons kind of do the same thing, except that they're also looking to see how much of the dotted line are left, and that represents the cancer. And anything that they can't see on that dotted line is what we use the chemotherapy for. Okay, so moving on, fractional kill hypothesis. This is also called log kill hypothesis. This assumes that homogeneous sensitivity of drugs will act in first order kinetics. This means that they will eliminate a constant proportion of cells rather than a constant number. So that's a distinction, right? Proportions are proportions. So, you know, you have more cells, the proportion's bigger. Cell kill is in a logarithmic form, which this is a log scale. Explains why multiple doses need to be given. So if you always kill a constant fraction each time you give a dose, you obviously know you need to have multiple fractions to add to one. You can argue that there's some asymptotic approach where you don't necessarily kill everything, but that's another talk. Drugs, it also explains why drugs only affecting specific steps in the cell cycle. So basically, when we have leukemia cells, acute leukemias, the S phase is about 18 to 20 hours. We give cytarabine every 12 hours so that we catch them going through the S phase. So the proportion is really important. This also establishes the role of adjuvant therapy because the surgery can only remove so much and there might be other small fractions left over. And then higher doses may give a larger proportion of cells killed. So this is a hypothesis that's important. It's not the answer. And then there's another hypothesis here. So this one reads, chemotherapy results in a rate of regression in tumor volume that is proportional to the rate of growth for an unperturbed tumor of that size. Log kill does not always work. What this is saying is that we have a heterogeneous, so cancers themselves are not, the clones are not all the same. So you have these trees that develop, you have mutations that accumulate, and then those have progenitors go down, you have progenitors. You have different clones, and they might all have a similar mutation at the top, and then they start to divide out, and you have less of the same mutations. So they're heterogeneous. The other thing that's really important is not all cells are dividing at the same speed. So as it turns out, the tumor itself, based on where you are in the cancer, and if you look at it as a golf ball, the more you drill into it, the cells on the outside might be rapidly dividing because their nutrients are easier to obtain and because they're more readily available. And then some of the core may actually be slower growing. So they argue if you give more frequent, lower doses, you may be able to kill a little bit, send more in a growth fraction, kill a little bit, send more in a growth fraction. So it introduces the idea of dose intensity and dose density. So what we would ideally want is the highest dose of chemotherapy with the shortest interval possible. So if we shorten the interval, the higher the dose, you kill more of the fraction. The fraction goes up. The more frequently you give it, the more you can kind of get to those heterogeneous cells. In theory, that's a nice way to think of it. But there are two theories going on here, intensity versus density. Intensity is variable dose over a fixed unit time. So we're looking at a dose of etoposide, 90 milligrams per meter squared for 3 days versus 60. So dose intensity is this 90 milligram dose as opposed to the 60 because it's a higher dose. This subjects patients to side effects, especially dose-limiting toxicities or toxicities that are related to the dose of drug. And this is, and for those ID and microbiology people, this is analogous to concentration-dependent antibiotics. Dose density is the fixed dose over a variable unit at time. So we can shorten the intervals between doses. So instead of every 14 or every 21 days, we give something every 14 days. And this is analogous to time-dependent antibiotics. So this is your standard regimen. This is your number of cells, cancer cells. This is time. Standard dose shows that you're slowly knocking down a fraction. Dose escalated allows you to have larger drops at the same intervals. And dose dense allows you to have more frequent dosing. This does kind of imply that dose dense is better, but clinically not always the case. So you can't look at that as an end-all be-all. So this is really where my world comes in a little bit. Pharmacologic properties of drugs. So why do so many drugs fail in therapy once they go to humans? And the way I think about this is if you have a dish of cancer cells, you dump bleach in it, you're going to kill them. And that's great because you've just killed all the cancer cells, but we don't give bleach to patients. And the movement here is a really big jump. And so we have a lot of different drug characteristics which are called pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, and pharmacogenomics. So kinetics is actually the study of the drug way through the body. So you have absorption, distribution, metabolism, and elimination. That's the way of things with kinetics. So there are variabilities in all of these steps depending on the drug, and they may differ from drug to drug. Dynamics is the study of the concentration of the drug at the site of effect. So how much drug is actually needed at the site of the cancer cell? That's important too. Because if we're not being able to penetrate into the tumor, it doesn't matter if you have the best drug in the world. It needs to get to the site of action. And then we have this genomics thing, which actually plays into the kinetics to some extent. And that the genomic variation between an individual may affect the kinetics and the dynamics of the drug. So genetic polymorphisms are important when we look at this. So basically here, and it kind of came out kind of crappy on here, but we have what we're talking about here is that we have a diagnosis is made, a drug is selected, drug schedule is designed to reach the target plasma concentration, so concentration that represents a good amount of penetration at the site of action. The drug is administered, we assess the patient, concentrations are determined. Do we get what we want, yes or no? If not, we go back to the drawing board. And that's really what this is all saying is that this pathway is really important when we think about going from benchtop to patient. So kinetics. This is really, really pharmacy world here. Basically, we have what's known as a simple IV bolus one compartmental model. So if you give a drug dose, a single dose, your concentration goes up at time zero, at the time that it was administered, and then it slowly comes down. What that represents is this model down here, where drug is given, it hangs out in the compartment, the body, one of the compartments in the body, and then it's eliminated. So absorption, if we look at it in a kinetic form, we bypass because there's no absorptions. Giving a drug IV, you don't have to worry about the gut absorbing the drug, and that's really important. Distribution, there's none. It's a one compartment. If you have multiple compartments, so this goes into the fat tissue, this goes into the CNS, that would be another compartment. This goes into the liver, another compartment. Vasculature. Metabolism, there's none because it's just straight up eliminated. This is a very, very simple model for drug and kinetics, and there's classes and semesters on this alone. And body systems are more complicated than this. But this gives you an idea that all of these things actually play a role in the drug. Then we get into dynamics. So this is a little bit of the kinetics. So this is more of a two-compartment model. So this is the blood. It goes into the tissue. There's some distribution that goes between the two of them. We worry about how much is actually sufficient. So how much receptor binding is required for the drug to work at the site of action? That's really what this is. The question of dynamics is. Is one out of three drug molecules enough to induce a signal and a response? Then with the dynamics, what this does is you create these curves here. So we have a drug, we're measuring drug concentrations. We have maximum effect, so 100% of the time we get an effect of the drug. This is 50% of the time, and you see an EC50. EC50 is important because that's a dynamic property, and when you look at studies and go into drug development, this is something to pay attention to. This EC50 is important, especially when you consider the opposite, which is LC50, which is more toxicity, so lethal dose or lethal concentration of 50% of the time. And the closer LC50 is to EC50 tells you how toxic the drug is. So if your concentration is essentially the same for effective concentration at 50% of the time and lethal concentration at the same time, that's called a narrow therapeutic drug. So drugs that the toxicity and the effect come hand in hand. We would like to think of chemotherapy as usually when these numbers are really close. They tend to be really close in chemotherapy. Things like over-the-counter Advil in patients that don't have any liver dysfunction or kidney dysfunction would have a bigger gap between the two of them, or bigger ratio between the two of them. And then you also have this thing where we look at the concentration, highest plasma concentration for the dose. So is there variability in the concentration in the body? This is really, really complicated. And what we have is the drug pathway through the body. So kinetics and dynamics are important. We have a prescribed dosing regimen. It works at the site of action, and then you have the effects. Along the way, you have things like compliance, errors, absorption, distribution issues, metabolism, hepatic interactions, sometimes with drugs themselves too, elimination and metabolism. And then you also have, are there enough receptors? Are the receptors expressed? Do they have genetic factors that are altering either the receptor or the metabolism of the drug, drug interactions, and sometimes we also have tolerance that develops. So that was really fast in the world of pharmacokinetics, dynamics, and genomics. This is really complex, and really that was the purpose of talking about it. If you do, though, master these and understand them, for those that are actually interested in drug development, you can make a lot of money. Because you take drugs that, you know, you may alter the chemical structure, and maybe you change one of these problems that, or these hurdles that are along the way. Also, it's important to understand these for dose intervals and actually developing regimens and dosing strategies. So how is dose calculated? Dose is the amount of drug given to a patient, usually milligrams or international units or some other unit. There are different dosing strategies. Fixed dose is that the dose is what it is. So you have a breast cancer patient that meets this criteria. You give 840 milligrams and then 420 thereafter. We also have age-based dosing, so pediatrics and infants. There's some variability in their weights and where they are in development, so we do age instead. Weight-based dosing, so this is a milligram per kilogram basis. So it's based on body weight. If you want to get into the specifics about that, there's things like total body weight. There's adjusted body weight. There's ideal body weight and what calculation you use. Sometimes that plays a role in it. Body surface area is the most common one. And if you're going to remember one of them, it would be this one. Height times weight divided by 3,600. You take the square root of that. So when you see cisplatin here, 75 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks, you go through this calculation, and you multiply 75 by this number, you get your dose. There are others, too. Sometimes they're based on kinetic principles. So all of that is complex, but we also have this thing called performance status. And performance status is actually an easy way to think about kinetics and dynamic variability. So let's say we have a patient that's, you have two patients. One you have is a 30-year-old athlete, me, and a 70-year-old chronic smoker on dialysis. We weigh the same weight, we're the same height, and we have the same type and stage of cancer. So we both have, acute myeloid leukemia. So are we different? This kind of says yes. So performance status is a standard measure to impact the disease on daily living. So I'm an athlete. My person standing next to me is a smoker on dialysis. I can perform normal daily living activities much, much better than maybe he can. And this is actually used extensively in clinical trials. This is the ECOG performance status. There's also Karnofsky, which is very similar to that. It's a grading of 0 to 5, 5 being dead, and 0 being most of us in this room. And then it goes from there. So changes in performance statuses are why doses and therapies changes. Underneath that all is differences in kinetics and dynamics. For example, it's very common knowledge that renal function or our kidney functions decrease over the course of our lifetime. So we get poorer and poorer at using our kidneys, and our kidneys get weaker and weaker. We also have differences in our metabolic enzymes as we age as well. And there's also, on the flip side, there's differences when we look at pediatrics. So this is helpful in trying to put really a basic scale to kinetics on an understanding that we all respond differently to drugs. Sometimes that response can be as simple as looking at how active a patient is, and that's pretty cool. So in the 70-year-old patient, we may start with a lower dose or a different therapy altogether. So based on our age, based on our performance status, we may go our first-line therapy for a drug for a cancer may be different. So the review of the principles so far, and hopefully I haven't lost anybody, but we can disrupt the cell cycle. That does something. It may give us some control over the cancer. We like to use combination agents. That'll improve outcomes and prevent resistance to some extent. Cell cancer growth is not constant. So we have cells going through the cell cycle. The growth fraction changes as a function of time and nutrients. Chemotherapy can be given at different doses, frequencies, and in combination with other modalities, so we have adjuvant therapy. We can also combine radiation, which we didn't really talk about radiation. How the drug reacts in a petri dish is completely different from the body, so we can't take bleach, give patients bleach, and expect good outcomes. Chemotherapy itself is toxic, and we tailor it to the patient and the cancer. So first-line therapy of a 20-year-old is different from first-line therapy of an 80-year-old, all things considered the same. So how does chemotherapy work? We're hijacking this process. So the cell cycle, this is now not a cycle, it's a chart going downwards. We have purines, pyrimidines. At the bottom, we have proteins, enzymes, more differentiation, microtubules, et cetera, et cetera. So proliferation. Anywhere that we can hit a spot, we can use a drug. And so these are the drugs that act in different areas. We'll talk about a bunch of them in the subsequent slides. I divide it up into two sections. So we have traditional chemotherapy, which are the old agents, the agents that have been around forever. They're cheap, sometimes on shortages. And then the new ones, which are these targeted therapies. So we're looking at protein function down here. Targeted therapies is the wave of the future. Since the mid-80s onwards, and sometimes more specifically 2000 and onwards as the cutoff for those. Those are readily available but expensive. So the cell cycle and chemotherapy. I like this picture because it actually tells a lot. This is the cell cycle. We have the G phases, S phase, G2, mitosis. We have drugs that are independent of the cell cycle. That means they act wherever they are. Doesn't matter where. And then we have ones that are cell cycle specific. And we'll go into those a little bit. In addition, these boxes around indicate how sensitive it is to radiation therapy. So in particular, radiation is effective in G2 and mitosis. So a few things to note. Cell cycle specific drugs interfere with faster growing cells. Hopefully that makes a little sense, because the faster you're going through the phases, the faster you'll come across the phases, and therefore the drug will be more effective. S and M are most important in that. We have the non-specific cells, and these interfere with more slow-growing cells. They inflict damage whenever DNA is needed, not just mitosis, so development of proteins, etc. So we're going to talk about non-cell cycle-specific chemotherapy. there are two major categories. We have alkylating agents and platinum compounds. They act the same way or very similarly with some distinction between them, which we'll slightly talk about. So alkylating agents are actually a very diverse group of drugs. There are loosely related compounds. There are the drug classes there. Things like cyclophosphamide is probably one of the drugs that might be most familiar to you guys in here. It's seen routinely in other diseases, not just cancer. What they do is they form highly reactive carbonium ion intermediates, which bind to amines, oxygens, and phosphates of DNA. N7-guanine of guanine is highly susceptible to these agents, but also N1, N3 adenine, N3 cytosine, and O6 guanine. Cells, what they'll do is they'll come across these in their normal processes and either try to repair the DNA or undergo cell cycle arrest. So they basically stop the normal functioning anytime you need the DNA. If it comes across one of these agents, it will either try to repair it or undergo apoptosis. The alkylating agents are extensively used in therapy. Most regimens have one of these agents in them, either the platinum compounds or the alkylating agents, because they're non-cell cycle specific. So whether or not they're in the cell cycle, they can provide some benefit. They are commonly combined with cell cycle dependent agents. So when we pick regimens and build regimens, we're usually using different ways that they work. Resistance, and cancer cells figure this out pretty quickly, just like bacteria, like bacterial resistance. We have chemotherapy resistance. Decreased permeation of active transported drugs. So if they're active transport, you know, we have passive diffusion, we have, you know, the facilitated transport, and then the active, right? So active requires energy. If you're able to slow that down, you can do that. Increased concentrations of nucleophilic substances that bind and inactivate these agents. So cancer cells create their own way to inactivate these things. And then this increased MMR or other repair mechanism. So MMR is mix-match repair. So these enzymes come along and fix all the mistakes that the DNA does. I'm not a chemist, and I don't expect people to really be tested on this or understand that. But basically, what we have here is this is mechloroethamine, which is an ancient old agent, which is not routinely used anymore in practice. They, when they go into water, they have this free electron pair that develops a charge. This is the free chlorine. This interacts with the DNA, and you basically have this big molecule sticking off of the DNA, blocking enzymatic pathways thereafter. Cyclophosphamide is our prototype compound for the class. This is similar to a drug called ifosfamide. This is one of the most extensive agents in therapy, and if most people are familiar with any drugs, it would be this one in particular. This is a prodrug. Prodrugs are drugs that are converted into the body to an active metabolite. So without the body's conversion, this drug has no activity. A prodrug requires the body to act on it to have an effect. And we have this active metabolite. So we have hepatic enzymes that converted into two metabolites. And they're in proportion to each other. We have inactive metabolites that come downstream from that. And then we also have our toxic metabolites. This phosphoramide mustard is the one that's really responsive for its anti-cancer activity. This acrolein actually is one of the main problem makers and causes a lot of the side effects with this drug. And this acrolein actually causes something called hemorrhagic cystitis, which basically means you're bleeding into your bladder and not really pleasant. So we try to limit this by increasing hydration, giving drugs that actually bind to this, etc. But it's important to note that we do have toxic metabolites. This one's active and is active against cancer. This one causes toxicity. So briefly on toxicities of chemotherapy, the first one we'll talk about is bone marrow suppression, or myelosuppression as it's also known. This is a class effect of alkylating agents, but it comes in varying degrees. What bone marrow suppression does is it lowers your platelets, your white blood cells, and your red blood cells. So you have thrombocytopenia, or low thrombocytes or platelets, neutropenia, your white blood cells, and anemia is your red blood cells. This can be used advantageously in bone marrow transplants. So patients that undergo bone marrow transplants actually, they use this myelosuppression to the benefit and is part of the reason why you do it. There are actually two forms of myelosuppression, and I'm going to walk around a little bit. The first one is the acute phase, or what normally happens in patients. This is a nadir in 7 to 10 days and recovery in 14 days. So these patients will have their white count go down 7 to 10 days later after chemotherapy, and then recover for 21 days. The one that's worse is the delayed myelosuppression. That's in the deer in 4 to 6 weeks. So that is like, you kind of recover from everything else, and then, oh crap, you have low white count. So why is there a concern? Obviously, thrombocytopenia, there's bleeding complications. Neutropenia is, we worry about infections. Anemia, and that goes along with fatigue and unable to really deal with the therapy, quality of life issues come up. Shortness of breath. GI toxicity, so this is probably the most well-known and respected area of toxicity because patients complain about it. And it's a really big quality of life issue. So we have mucosal ulceration, so mucositis, or basically they develop sores in their GI tract. We have things like chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. We have multiple redundant pathways that go into the brain that trigger nausea and vomiting. It varies depending on agents in varying degrees. So there's a dose relationship with this. So higher dose chemotherapy sometimes has higher nausea and vomiting. Also depends on the agent. So there are a lot of chemotherapies that cause absolutely no nausea and vomiting at all, and we actually don't treat them or even prophylax or prevent nausea and vomiting in these patients. There's also constipation and diarrhea. So moving on from the alkylating agents into the platinum compounds, these act in a very similar fashion, except that they have platinum molecules in them. Not enough to make a nice ring or watch, but there's platinum in them. They covalently bind to the DNA in a very similar fashion. They do the same thing. So when you look at them, they're essentially interchangeable in most regimens, not that you would interchange them, but there's usually one or the other in many regimens. There are three members of this class. There's cisplatin, carboplatin, and oxaliplatin. These two, cis and carboplatin, actually share similar activity and are somewhat interchangeable. So this is very similar to what we have with things like statins in other areas. So statins we use for heart disease and cholesterol, and there are lots of statins. For the most part, we consider them interchangeable. And for the most part, we consider cis and carbo interchangeable. We're changing why you'd use one over the other is potentially side effects and the incidence and degree. Oxaliplatin is not. So what happens to these agents is they get put in water, and then these molecules, the chlorines get displaced by water. This is highly reactive, very similar to the alkylating agents, then therefore causing your effect. So they're resistant. Cis and carbo share cross-resistant, while oxaliplatin doesn't. Oxaliplatin is usually used in a different spectrum of cancers. These also, a loss of function and mismatch repair can cause issues, and then also upregulation of DNA repair genes. So this is a mechanism of action. So the chlorine molecules get displaced by water. The guanine it binds there, and you have cross-link. So you have DNA polymerase coming up here, or topoisomerase or something like that. It comes across this. It can't do its thing. It may try to repair it or induce apoptosis. S-phase and antimetabolites. So now we're specifically targeting S-phase, and these are cell cycle-specific drugs. Folic acid. Folic acid is something that is required for development, and if anyone knows anybody in the room that's ever been pregnant or conceiving or anything like that, prenatal vitamins have folic acid in them. And folic acid is needed for cell growth and differentiation. It's one of the precursors in purine and pyrimidine synthesis. Really important. Well, if you have molecules that look like folic acid, you can actually slow that process down. And so you have things like methotrexate, pralatrexate, and pemetrexate that look, and you know, again, I'm not a chemist, but they look very close. You can convince yourself that they are. And they have very similar activity, except that when you use these drugs instead of folic acid, it inhibits the process because it's not folic acid. So Sidney Farber was the one that discovered that. You know, he was that guy from Dana-Farber. He's from Buffalo. He discovered aminopterin back in the 1940s. This is what's known as a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor. This depletes tetrahydrofolate, and we'll talk about tetrahydrofolate, that's necessary for purine and pyrimidine synthesis. There's decreased active transport into the cell. That's how they can be resistant. You can actually alter dihydrofolate reductase that impairs binding, or you can overexpress it, and that's kind of like competitively allowing things to go through. You can efflux it out. You can tell that this is a big molecule and that's not going through passive diffusion. And that's one of the other ways. Side effects for the methotrexate and antifolates is myelosuppression, mucositis. Mucositis is pretty bad with this. So is the myelosuppression, but mucositis is problematic for patients. There's some nephrotoxicity and neurotoxicity as well. So, this is folic acid, FH2. FH2 becomes tetrahydrofolate through dihydrofolate reductase. When we bind methotrexate here, this prevents folic acid from becoming tetrahydrofolate. FH2 polyglutamate actually accumulates, and that's actually cytotoxic, so cytotoxic here. DUMP is converted into thiamine monophosphate, DTMP, a component of DNA. So tetrahydrofolate is metabolized further, and you get here, where you have now the thiamine monophosphate component of DNA. And then that goes on to DNA. We have 5-fluorouracil, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Then we have this other molecule called leucovorin. And leucovorin is another form of folic acid, except it's on the other side. So tetrahydrofolate and leucovorin are the same thing, essentially. And this is actually used as a drug. So what we can do with leucovorin is, and how this is actually used in therapy, is two ways. Those patients that are actively trying to commit suicide, they have methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis, they take the whole bottle. We give them a dose of leucovorin. It doesn't matter what happens here, everything's good because we can still continue the process. So that's one of the ways that we can use it. And that's probably an easy way to understand what we're going to do with it on the other extreme. So if we give a high dose of methotrexate, and we give a really, really high dose of methotrexate, so the reasons for that is if we have to treat a cancer that's active in the brain, or a cancer that's active in the bone. Those are poor penetrating cancers, so drugs don't go to there very easily or very readily. We give a high dose so that they can get there and get in a high enough concentrations, the pharmacodynamics, and have an effect. So we get that effect, so we give a large dose of methotrexate. But we have this list of side effects here, myelosuppression, mucositis, nephrotoxicity. If we give the leucovorin after we give the methotrexate, we actually improve those other areas and improve the side effect profile and the tolerability of high-dose methotrexate. So it's kind of a cool thing to do. So methotrexate is also another drug that's used extensively. As I mentioned before, it's used in rheumatic diseases. It's used in cancer extensively as well. Can be given orally, IV, or intrathecally. And intrathecally is administration into the CNS fluid. So they do a spinal tap, shoot you with some methotrexate, and send you on your way. There is that high-dose methotrexate, which I was talking about. This requires therapeutic blood monitoring. We use leucovorin rescue because these patients are going to have side effects. We also have to alkalinize the urine, which means we change the pH of the urine so it's excreted better, so changing the elimination properties. And then this also penetrates the CNS. So we have a large molecule in the blood-brain barrier, which is very impermeable, and we need high doses to get things through. Moving on from methotrexate in that class, we also have pyrimidine and purine analogs. We have on your left, purines, pyrimidines. What happens is these yellow highlighted components, if you replace them with the red, that is the difference between the purine and pyrimidine and the drug form of that. So they're false base pairs, and that's how they work. So you have, when you're forming DNA, when you're forming RNA, if you put in one of these dummy things, it's close enough to be entered or close enough to be picked up, but not good enough to get the job done and go through with it. So that's how it actually works. They're used in all, they can be used in various regimens. They can be combined with antifolates, so they can be combined with methotrexate. Purine and pyrimidine analogs can be put together in a regimen, so they can be used together. And they can also be put with nonspecific things. Generally, when we build regimens, we usually pick drugs with different mechanisms of action, and this is really the only exception to that. So when we look at a regimen later, it will have different mechanisms of action. These classes you can actually use together, although the toxicities then start to accumulate. So 5-fluorouracil is a pyrimidine analog. This is a prodrug. And what's cool about 5-fluorouracil is actually if you change the way that you give the drug, you change the mechanism of action. So that's another interesting thing about cancer agents and drugs in general. If you change the mechanism of action, sometimes you can actually change how the drug works. You change the administration route, you can change the way the drug works. So if you give this as a continuous infusion, you inhibit TS leading to thymidine deficiency. And we'll go back to that. We use leucovorin, and that actually stabilizes the drug complex. So that's another use for leucovorin, by the way. So we can change the drug properties by changing the administration. If you give it as a bolus or a quick IV infusion, so like a shot, that's a bolus, you have false integration into RNA and DNA, which you would expect. Pharmacogenomics actually plays a role in this drug. We have DPD, it's polymorphic, and clearance changes in these polymorphisms. So if you have a loss of function allele, you can actually see the clearance decrease in these patients. Resistance is due to reduced conversion of the active metabolite. Amplification of TS or alteration, so we change the drug at the site of action. And we have also amplification of degradative enzymes, so breaking down the drug before it does its thing. So if we actually go back to this slide here, this is 5-fluorouracil. So you have DUMP here. This goes through thymidylate synthetase that forms this DTMP, which is a component of DNA, and a purine and pyrimidine precursor. This binds to here, preventing it from doing its thing. Now, you can also do things like, as I said, you have different mechanisms that you have this. You continuous infusion, you go down by one pathway. The bolus, you go down another pathway. So you have RNA and DNA dysfunction. As it turns out, there are regimens that use both a bolus and continuous infusion. And that's called FOLFOX. It actually was developed at Roswell. So you have oxaliplatin, which is the platinum that we talked about before. Leucovorin. Leucovorin is used to stabilize the 5-fluorouracil. And then we have 5-fluorouracil given in two different forms. So we have a quick IV push, or a shot, if you will, and then a continuous infusion. And these patients go home on a pump for 46 hours. Side effects actually change as a function of how the drug's given. So myelosuppression angina, which is chest pain. And then continuous, you have diarrhea, mucositis, the GI toxicities. There is an antidote to this drug as well that's called uridine triacetate. So this is based on uracil, so uridine triacetate. Structurally similar, helps the body recover. Cytarabine is the next drug. And now I think we'll pick up a little bit more speed going through the drugs. This is cytosine arabinoside, or ARA-C, as it's also abbreviated. This is a prodrug that's converted into ARA-CTP. This causes false base integration, leading to inhibition of DNA polymerase. Side effects to this drug are also dose-dependent. You have myelosuppression. And at high doses, you have cerebellar syndrome, and conjunctivitis. What happens with these patients is actually one of the ways you can look for cerebellar syndrome is if you have them write their name. You know, we have a nice fluid movement through our signatures. These look like if you took your non-dominant hand and had that herky-jerky kind of fighting your way through the signature, and that's a symptom of cerebellar syndrome. Conjunctivitis is also a problem, so problems with the eye. 6, mercaptopurine. This is our purine analog that we're going to talk about. This was developed in 1953 with Sidney Farber and used in the pediatric ALL patients. It is still being used today in maintenance therapy for these patients. This inhibits purine synthesis and false integration. Side effects include hepatotoxicity and myelosuppression. The reason why we're talking about this, and this is azathioprine, which is a parent compound, which is also a drug. Azathioprine is used in transplant patients, kidney transplant patients. It's related to 6-mercaptopurine, which is here. 6-mercaptopurine is metabolized in active metabolites. Resistance is inhibition of here, downregulation here, and then all these other pathways that happen after here. These molecules here, METIMP, TGMP, they're the ones that are responsible for its action. And this TPMT is actually polymorphic. So every time you see TPMT, that's polymorphic. What that does is it kind of shunts things. And patients have decreased TPMT activity. So what ends up happening is you have different alleles. STAR2, 3A, 3C, they're reduced function alleles. So heterozygous patients for these actually have reduced function. The loss of function may actually increase over response, but it may also increase overall toxicity. And then these patients will have problems with myelosuppression. So we sometimes do genetic testing on these to see, especially when you have severe myelosuppression with standard 6-MP doses. Natural products. So this is always funny for me because, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are green and, you know, for lack of better terms, hippie-ish. And that's fine. You know, there are people that like natural products. And it's always very funny to me because there are these natural products that we'll talk about that will kill you. So you always have to, it's kind of a funny thing, tongue-in-cheek, but in reality, we get a lot of good stuff from nature at the same time. So topoisomerase, we have 2 different types of topoisomerase, type 1 and type 2. It's easy to remember because type 1 actually causes a single-strand break. Type 2 is a double-strand break. And that breaks the DNA. So we have drugs that inhibit type 1 and type 2. The first one is an anthracycline known as doxorubicin. So anthracyclines are a class of anti-tumor antibiotics. So they were originally thought to maybe be an antibiotic, but are actually effective in that. They're used in cancer. It was from a strep species. Class includes things like daunorubicin, epirubicin, and idarubicin. This is a prodrug as well, so the body needs to convert it. You have 2 different mechanisms of action, not dependent on administration, but you have topoisomerase 2 inhibition, which prevents religation of DNA. And you also have DNA intercalation as well, so it can enter as a free base pair. Resistant is upregulation of PGP or MDR1. They're the same thing if you see them in literature, that effluxes doxorubicin out. Side effects. This one is cardiotoxicity, and this is additive effects when you use cyclophosphamide with it. So much so that the cardiotoxicity is really important when we look at lifetime dosing. So these patients can only get so much of doxorubicin over their entire course of their entire lifetime. Or if you go over that threshold, they actually have cardiotoxicity. They have, it's kind of like a heart failure-like presentation. Causes myelosuppression, alopecia, mucositis, nausea, vomiting. It is a vesicant, which means it burns when it gets infused, if it's infused too quickly. And then this red discoloration. So doxorubicin, what's really cool about it is you see ruby in there. It's red in color. It's a very, very pretty color, actually. And so what ends up happening is it discolors the urine, tears, CNS fluid, sweat sometimes. Really crazy stuff, really crazy side effects. But you have to warn patients about it because, you know, if they start sweating red, it's kind of scary to them. Etoposide, or etoposide, depending on who you talk to. It comes from the mandrake plant, which is the Harry Potter reference. Topoisomerase 2 is a stabilization of TOPE2 complex. This leads to accumulation of cells in the S phase, and that leads to apoptosis. Side effects, alopecia and myelosuppression. So with this one, you have some PGP upregulation with the resistance, repair of DNA breaks, alterations to topoisomerase 2. Irinotecan, this one comes from a Chinese tree. I'm not going to pronounce it. I'm not really good at Latin. It's a prodrug, inhibits topoisomerase 1, so irinotecan topoisomerase 1. I remember it, 1I, Roman numeral. It's an easy way to remember it. This is a prodrug, which is really important because it's converted into this active metabolite known as SN38. SN38 is inactivated by UGT1A1, so we have SN38 binds to topoisomerase. It also binds to UGT1A1, which inactivates the drug. What's really important about that is UGT1A1 is polymorphic. So polymorphic, now we have the metabolism is being affected by this polymorphism, so there's actually an accumulation of SN38. The most pronounced side effect to this drug is diarrhea, as bad diarrhea. Patients will have like 3 to 4 bowel movements a day, and it goes on for days and days and days unless it's treated. It does cause some alopecia and myelosuppression, but the diarrhea is really, really a big one. So much so that the polymorphism is important clinically. So we have irinotecan AUC, and AUC is a kinetic measure of the amount of drug over time in the body. Exposure, calculus principle. UGT is 1A1. This is the irinotecan exposure in the body. You have wild type, you have the homozygous mutant, and then you have heterozygous. So the irinotecan, the amount of irinotecan in the body doesn't actually change between the different polymorphic groupings. But when you actually look at the active metabolite, you see that patients that are normal have less active metabolite floating around. The ones that are heterozygous actually have a little bit more. And the ones that have the mutant on both sides is even more. And there's actually greater diversity. So based on this, the ones that actually have a lot of diarrhea are these. But we also have diarrhea here. And you can kind of clinically, phenotypically just say, you probably have one of these. We don't generally test for it unless it's really, really severe. Antimitotic agents, so these are still, we're still talking about natural products. We have the ones that act on mitosis now instead of topoisomerase. So we moved out of topoisomerase and now into mitosis and antimitotic agents. There are two major classes here. So there are building blocks of microtubules. There's an alpha and a beta. The alpha and beta build together and they build these chains out to the metaphase plate. So they line up here, they bind to the kinetochore, and then disassemble back to the spindle pole. So they go back to their respective sides. That's how it works in you know, real life. What ends up happening is that there are drugs that target both the assembly and disassembly. So we have the drugs that act at the growth, and then we have drugs that act in the disassembly. And they're two different classes. So vincas prevent assembly, so they prevent growth. Vinca alkaloids prevent growth. Taxanes prevent disassembly, so there's a distinction between the two of them. The taxanes actually stabilize the spots in here, and then the vincas actually prevent the binding. So taxanes, polymerizing agents, they were discovered from the Pacific yew tree. This is a very famous drug class. There are actually... I was at the Botanical Gardens a few weeks ago, and they actually have one of these yew trees in there. I was like, oh, that's really cool. I got to get one for home. I haven't been able to find it yet, though. What they do is they inhibit depolarization by binding to beta tubulin, causing mitotic arrest. There are many members of this class. We have paclitaxel, docetaxel, cabazitaxel, etc. These drugs are extremely hydrophobic, and I don't have a structure picture, but they don't go very well into water, and so much so that they actually need oil for dissolution. So in order for us to give these to patients, there's usually an oil-water mix that's administered because the drug's in oil, we give it in a saline bag, which is water, and you can actually see them mixing like a salad dressing. Castor oil actually causes a lot of allergic reactions, so one of the major side effects of this class is allergic reactions. It can be from the drug, and also can be from the oil base that it's in. I like to think of the taxanes, and when I teach the taxanes, I like to think of them as causing everything, side effect-wise, except that it's not necessarily the highest intensity. It's probably a step down from that. So you see myelosuppression, alopecia. You see neuropathy. Patients have myalgias. They swell. They may have cardiac problems, nausea, vomiting, and the list goes on and on and on. Flipping sides, you have the vincas, which we're working on depolarization. They inhibit polymerization by binding the beta tubulin and stabilizing it. Vincristine, vinblastine, vinorelbine are the class members that are in therapy. These drugs are fatal if they're given intrathecally. Novions in the spine is the way that pharmacy students are taught this. This is important, and why this is actually a thing is that they're administered as a little shot, so an IV shot. There are other drugs that it's used with that are also given as an IV shot, and they're given intrathecally. So sometimes what happens is nurses or doctors will switch the syringes, and then patients die. It hasn't happened here. It hasn't happened in a while, but it's a real thing. What that helps me remember, and the moral of the story is that these cause neurotoxicity. And that's an easy way to remember the side effect. So you have also peripheral neuropathy, and then these patients get constipation. So neurotoxicity with these agents is really an important thing. It does cause myelosuppression, albeit not very commonly. And so these actually come from periwinkle, and they're pretty. And so you see vinca plants. They're annuals if you have gardens. They're not from those. They're from Madagascar periwinkle, but same family of plants. Oops. Okay, so activities. This is really a broad slide that just goes over the different drugs and where they're going to be used. It's just for your information. I'm not really going to go into it very much because there's not a lot of depth to it. You have various activities of drugs that are used over a variety of diseases, and you really have to look at how they're used in combination with each other. So from our traditional agents, these are the traditional agents as a class, as a group. There's a lot of them, and we only covered a few of them. But we had the major ones. They're used in a variety of cancers. Members of the same drug class may have different side effect profiles. So we talked about cis and carboplatin. Those drugs have very different, well, not very different, but they have different side effects. And you may choose one over another based on their side effects. Regimens are used in combination with multiple mechanisms of actions. So we balance the side effects and use different mechanisms of actions. Drugs can be administered in different ways, and that can alter their effects on the body. So 5-fluorouracil, giving it as a shot versus a continuous infusion, changes the way the drug works. Drugs respond differently in different patients, so we have polymorphisms that may actually play a role clinically, which is really important. And then side effects are dose-dependent. So chemotherapy. Agents need to be active against the cancer. But when we build regimens, we have different mechanisms of actions, hopefully different resistant mechanisms. Dose-limiting toxicities are different. So we want to balance toxicities across the board. We want to pick different mechanisms of action, and we want to make sure the resistant mechanisms are also different. So basically, a combination needed to maximize kill and limit resistance. And so we look at the principles. So we're balancing efficacy and toxicity. And sometimes that's a very difficult balance to make and depends on the disease. So putting it all together in a regimen, we have this regimen known as CHOP. CHOP is a very, very, very famous regimen if you read pharmacology or had a pharmacology class and they talked about chemotherapy. This is the one I learned in undergrad, and you know, I've learned several times since then. It's the CHOP stands for different drugs, and we'll look at it. So the C is cyclophosphamide, the H is doxorubicin. It's H because doxorubicin is also known by a different name. Hydroxydonorubicin is the name of it. That's different, but they're the same chemical, so that's how the H, you know. When you're making these major regimens and drug studies, you want fancy names, so that's what you do. O is Oncovin or vincristine. Oncovin is the brand name for vincristine. And P is prednisone. We didn't cover prednisone, but prednisone is a steroid. It's an immunosuppressant. So let's note the mechanism of action of these agents. We have an alkylating agent. It's nonspecific. We have doxorubicin, which is a topoisomerase 2 inhibitor, which is the S phase. We have vincristine, which is an antimitotic, the M phase. And we have prednisone. That's an immunosuppressant. This is lymphoma. Lymphoma is a cancer of the immune system. It's designed to be cytotoxic against those cells. Now, if you look at the toxicities, they're somewhat balanced as well. The renal dysfunction is with cyclophosphamide. You have alopecia there. Cardiotoxicity is nowhere else to be seen. Nausea, vomiting is too common to really fight out, but it's there. We have myelosuppression in both places. Those two are kind of hard to fight out. But the other toxicities, we try to balance them as much as we can. So when you look at this, this is what a standard regimen looks at. Looks like we balance mechanism and we balance toxicity. So as time goes on, traditional agents are indiscriminate killers of cells. They kill cells, good, bad, so they may kill the cancer cells, and they may kill your GI tract. How do we know the good cells from the bad cells? Well, traditional agents use a very bad assumption. They assume that all rapidly dividing cells are bad, and they also assume that all slow dividing cells are good. But we know cancers are heterogeneous, so some are fast dividing, some are not. And then our bodies, some are fast dividing, some are not. So it's really not a really good target. So drug development has come a long way. In the 1980s, we had all-trans-retinoic acid, or ATRA, that's used in a drug called acute promyelocytic leukemia, acute leukemia, which is severe. But what this does is it actually targets immature leukemic cells and causes them to differentiate. And it breaks the cycle of the formation of the cancer. It was pretty cool. At the same time, we had tamoxifen come out. And tamoxifen was a drug that's active in breast cancer, cancers that are hormone responsive. And what they've discovered is tamoxifen binds to estrogen receptors. Estrogen receptors are found throughout the body. There's estrogen receptors in breast tissue. There's estrogen receptors in ovarian tissue. Tamoxifen preferentially targets the breast tissue, which means that you can kind of limit the toxicity of combined estrogen blockade, which has its own limitations. So these two agents were really the start of that targeted therapy. So therapy is moving towards more targeted approaches. This, what I call carpet bombing versus tactical bombing, you know, we're moving towards getting out of the World War II carpet bombing and into more precision bombing with cancer. Targeted therapy, more appropriately termed molecularly targeted therapy. These target specific genes, tissues, and proteins. These are specific to the types of cancers, and this is where oncology is really taking off in its complexity, because now we're worried about genetic pathways and different expressions. So this is an understanding of cancer pathophysiology. It requires genotyping. A lot of these cancers will require, we got to do genetic tests to see if we can use this drug in you. What makes a good target? Well, ideally, we'd want targets that are only present in or on cancer cells. So something that makes the cancer cell completely unique from the rest of the body. That would be ideal. What happens more commonly is that we have they're more commonly found on cancer cells. These off-target effects, so even though they're more commonly, they sometimes hit something else, that's part of the toxicity equation and why they have side effects. Or we use both, they target both, but the normal cells can regenerate and regenerate readily. So, small molecule inhibition, these are tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I like to think of them as intracellular monoclonal antibodies. And I changed the targeted therapy from the way that I was originally going to talk about it. I know that targeted therapy is going to come up elsewhere. So I'm going to switch gears and talk about small molecule inhibitors in the context of CML. To kind of catch you up, our original targeted therapies were beyond Atra and tamoxifen. We had drugs like Herceptin, trastuzumab, Rituxan. Those were monoclonal antibodies. Monoclonal antibodies don't go into cells very easily. There are ways to get them in there, but they really don't go that well. And so they're extracellular, and they only can affect the transmembrane protein that sends the signal downstream. Small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors actually are the intracellular side of that. So they bind to the intracellular side of the transmembrane protein, or they may bind somewhere else in the signal transduction pathway. So tyrosine kinase phosphorylates from ATP, tyrosine, serine, threonine, signaling pathway for survival and proliferation. So these are proliferation pathways. Class of drug mainly acts through competitive inhibition of ATP binding domains. They may also target downstream, which I talked about, RAS, RAF, MEK, ERK. Those things are targeted by drugs as well. They're more downstream. Oops. So four key issues with these drugs, and this is more of a pharmacy point. These drugs as a class generally interact with CYP3A4. CYP3A4 is a common drug interaction form. This also, usually if you have 3A4, you have activity against PGP and MDR1. So that's just usually what happens. There's some homology in the structures. These drugs are either administered with or without food. Food interactions can be important. So they can change the kinetics of the drug. They can change the absorption or metabolism of the drug even. Acidity of the stomach. This is really important because these drugs affect the acidity, or the acidity is important for their absorption. So patients that are on things like heartburn medications actually interact with some of these drugs. And that's really important to keep in mind. And then compliance. So this is where my world comes in. We want, ideally, patients get 100% of the dose, but I wouldn't be lying if I told you I have stopped an antibiotic pack too early, even though I'm a pharmacist and I know better. And so if I'm doing that, I know other people are doing it, and it's part of human nature. So CML. The reason why I decided to switch gears and talk about this is because instead of going through the drug classes like I did before, I feel like I could hit all the principles that are important to targeted therapy by talking about the disease itself. So hopefully this goes very well. So when we thought about the magic bullet, we have something that's pretty close here that has actually like changed this disease from a death sentence to a success story, and very analogous to the HIV story where we had AIDS and then AZT came out and all these other inhibitors for HIV, they've changed that disease into a chronic disease as opposed to a terminal diagnosis. And so the drugs in this class, or drugs that are active in CML, are actually responsible for doing that. So I know that you guys talked a little bit about CML, right? Yeah. So we have Philadelphia chromosome. Translocations of 9 and 22. You put BCR and ABL next to each other with this fusion oncogene. BCR-ABL is a tyrosine kinase that's independent of needing a signal, so it's constantly turned on. And it is there in CML 95% of the time. So what we have here is that translocation where BCR and ABL are next to each other. This turns that tyrosine kinase on all the time, and that's a problem. So CML itself as a disease comes in different phases. And when we think about staging, this is what we're kind of talking about, where it is in the process. And without actually going into staging in great detail, we have different phases, and so analogous to staging. So we have late chronic phase, which is chronic phase still, accelerated phase, and blast crisis. This is time, genetic instability. As you go up this line, you have oncogenic addition to BCR-ABL, so accumulation of other mutations. So the chronic phase usually lasts about 3 to 5 years. Patients are asymptomatic. They may have elevated counts. The accelerated phase happens over the course of months, where you have peripheral blasts, which are immature white cells floating around. They shouldn't be out of the bone marrow. So when you see them, that's not really a good thing. You start to see other myeloid toxicities, so we see thrombocytopenia. We have clonal evolution, which means that we are actually starting to accumulate mutations. And then nonspecific symptoms, so this is where it becomes a little bit more symptomatic in this accelerated phase, where you have fatigue, night sweats, and fever. Which makes sense, because these are white blood cells. And when we start to, when we have an infection, we are tired, we sometimes sweat at night, and we have a fever. So they're all explained by the disease itself. And then blast crisis is when CML turns into acute leukemia, and that's bad. So our goal in therapy is keeping patients here. The nice thing about CML is that there's only one mutation that's responsible for it. So when the Human Genome Project hit its climax in 2000, we thought, okay, so if we can find all the mutations that are responsible for cancer, we target those mutations, we can shut off the cancer. And they're like, hey, look at Gleevec and CML. And CML was basically, these patients were crushing the comparator arm in the study, like crushing, like completely mind-blowing. And it revolutionized it. And so that was the success story. It was such a profound difference from the standard of care that it was just unbelievable. And you only hoped as a researcher or someone in the field that you could find a Gleevec for every disease. So inhibition, what it does is inhibits BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase. It does it in the active conformation. This is only active in Philadelphia chromosome positive CML. This also targets SARC, KIT, and platelet-derived growth factor as well. So those are the off-target effects of this agent. Those off-target effects oftentimes correspond to these side effects. So we have edema, rash, nausea, myalgias, myelosuppression, and hepatotoxicity. What happens with this one, and the reason why these patients may progress on this, is that the BCR-ABL kinase binding domain, there's mutations that happen there. You can also over-amplify BCR-ABL. But the important thing is that this drug really changed therapy. So it was a single agent. So these patients only got imatinib or Gleevec, and they had phenomenal responses. So this is the BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase, CML progression. Imatinib fits where ATP would bind, preventing ATP from binding and preventing the signal cascade. The TKIs have class side effects. We have things, the neutropenia, the myelosuppression, and we have rash. So a little better tolerated. The myelosuppression we can deal with. And to some extent, that might be a question of whether or not it's a disease or also the toxicity. So imatinib was great. Everyone did good on it. There's a question about how long you should give it for. Should it be continuous forever for only a short period of time? That answer is still being debated out. So they're like, well, can we improve on imatinib? And so dasatinib came out. Dasatinib is the second generation. It's 325 times more potent than imatinib. So potency is how we measure drugs' effects. Giving less of one drug, where is it equivalent to another drug? So where are they equivalent in their dosing? So that's what potency is. If drug A is 325 times more potent than drug B, so 325 milligrams of drug B is needed to equal 1 milligram of drug A, in a very simplistic sense of how it works. So these bind to the active and inactive conformations of the BCR-ABL kinase domain. What's really important about dasatinib is, one, it works very fast. It works faster than imatinib. Two, it's active in all BCR-ABL mutations resistant to imatinib. So if patients progress on imatinib for whatever reason. You can go to dasatinib. They're structurally related, but they're different enough, one, that the potency's there, two, they can bind to active and inactive, and three, there's also differences in toxicity. So we had myalgias, edema, rash, myelosuppression. With the dasatinib, now we have pulmonary arterial hypertension. So lung effects and edema, which is also a lung type side effect. So now we have two agents that can be used with different side effect profiles. We're picking one versus another. And both can be used first line. The thing that makes the dasatinib unique is that, one, it's active in the resistant cancers, except for this T315I mutation. Pearls about this one, it can be used first line or after progression. And you can't use PPIs, which are a heartburn medication, or H2 blockers. So these are gastric reflux agents, heartburn medications. So if you have heartburn or you have pulmonary disease, dasatinib might not be a good first line option for you. So you're picking based on toxicity. Nilotinib came along. So this is like imatinib 2.0. This one is 30 times more potent than imatinib, binds to the close, and has a higher affinity and better fit than imatinib. It also binds to c-kit and platelet-derived growth factor. The thing about this one, which is different from the other ones, is now we have twice daily. Compliance and the ability of patients to take drugs is really, really important. Twice a day. When you go from once a day to twice a day, your compliance rates drop by about 25% in normal drugs, in other drugs. We're not talking cancer drugs. And unfortunately, with cancer drugs, I don't think the data is very much different from that. So we lose a lot of compliance. This one can be used first line or after progression. The thing about this one that's different from myalgias, which is different from pulmonary toxicity, is that this one has cardiac toxicity. So EKGs with all the lines going to you and you watch the zigzag on the monitor, EKG, we're looking for abnormalities there. They may be electrolyte abnormalities, electrolyte imbalances. You might have hepatic toxicity. So patients with underlying cardiac disease, patients that probably can't take twice a day drugs, might not be good for this drug. But this drug also can be used in patients that have progressed on imatinib. So initial selection of TKI therapy. There is potency difference. What does that mean to therapy, though? So potency does actually change overall survival. So it's great that nilotinib and dasatinib are more potent. They actually do reach a complete response faster, so they get a response faster. The response is very significantly faster, but it doesn't make a difference in overall survival. So when we look at that in therapy, and when we come up with guidelines, we say they're all equivalent first line based on patient preferences, patient characteristics. So we choose imatinib, dasatinib, or nilotinib, considering their toxicity, ability to tolerate therapy, comorbid conditions, and risk. Makes sense. So we have second generations have a faster time to respond, but long-term survival is not established yet. So there doesn't appear to be the evidence for using one over the other really isn't clear right now, and so they're all considered frontline therapy. So as it turns out, if you have progression or lack of effect, you can move from one agent to the other. So if you start with imatinib, you can go to the dasatinib and then nilotinib, in theory. You start with the dasatinib, you can go to the nilotinib. You can't go from the dasatinib to imatinib, though. They don't recommend that. But there's also another drug called bosutinib. And bosutinib is a second generation. It's 200 times more potent than imatinib, has activity in imatinib-resistant and dasatinib and nilotinib-resistant tumors. But it's second line. The drug company, what they did is they failed to beat imatinib head-to-head frontline therapy. So they did a non-inferiority study, which means they looked at both drugs, said, it was a superiority study. So they said, we think the bosutinib is actually going to be imatinib. And it didn't. Because of that, it moved to second-line therapy because it can't beat front-line therapy. So this one's once daily, failed to beat imatinib front-line. And it's the PPIs, or heartburn medications, decreased concentrations. Toxicities include hepatic toxicity and diarrhea. Third line therapy, so now we're talking about adding a second or third TKI can be considered. Again, if imatinib is not used first line, can't use it after a front line therapy. You can go to the stem cell transplant, and you know that's an option. It's not a popular option currently. You can go to a different drug now, omisetaxine, which is indicated in the failure or intolerance of two or more TKIs. So if you fail imatinib, then dasatinib, you can go to omisetaxine. The nice thing about Cinribo is that it binds to ribosomal protein. So we now have a different mechanism of action. Does not bind to BCR-ABL. The thing about this drug is that this is also given daily, or actually twice daily, and it's given sub-Q. I have a hard time getting patients to comply with sub-Q injections. And I think I'm almost over, and I am. I'm sorry. T315 CML, this clinical trial, omisetaxine can be used here. Now, there's another TKI that can be used, ponatinib. This one is indicated only in T315I mutations, or in those patients where no other TKI is indicated. This has a black box warning. The problem with this drug is it causes life-threatening blood clots. And when it was originally brought to the market, they're like, that's a lot of toxicity for the drug. We shouldn't have it on the market. But this mutation is pretty nasty because that mutation actually makes all the other TKIs not work, and the other TKIs cannot work in that. Ponatinib actually works in here. So, I think we only have a couple more slides. Resistance. When we talked about the resistance and the mutations that occur naturally, natural resistance to imatinib is rare, which is different from other diseases. Secondary resistance is more common, so conformational changes happening to the BCR-ABL site. T315I mutations have the highest risk of resistance. This is a gatekeeper mutation. The mutations may be helpful in selecting the alternative. So when patients progress, they'll do a mutational analysis and see if we can use something else. So when patients start progressing, so we see blasts happening, we see changes in their counts, they might be going into that accelerated phase. We do an analysis, say, hey, what's going on? The hope is to send them back in that chronic phase. So compliance, this is actually really important and more important to me probably. But basically what it does is they looked in a trial, adherence to imatinib, greater or less than 80% compliance. So in the course of a month, are they hitting at least 85% of their doses? And what does that do to response? What it does is it actually changes their response. So these patients sometimes progress, and one of the major reasons for resistance is actually noncompliance or more than really 15 or so percent of the time. That's really, really scary about this. So you got to be on point with these agents, which is really important because you need to have the drug in order to have your effect. So the accelerated phase is when the stuff hits the fan. The goal is to return the chronic phase. What we can do with these agents is dose them a little higher. So if you go back and pharmacy-wise, you'd see that the doses are a little different. That gives you a quicker response, which is why we care about quicker response now. So indicating now that that's important. And then we can also use omisetaxine or allotransplant. Blast crisis, which is the bad side of things, is really, we talk about acute leukemia, which is, you know, more aggressive therapy plus a TKI. So, message on targeted therapy, value in me-too drugs. So different members of the same class sometimes have different activity. You sometimes can pick what you're going to use in a patient if they're all front line based on their toxicity profile. There, both the similarities in agents and differences matter. So does the advantage provide any in any way? So is the toxicity profile more favorable in a situation? Is there a mutation that makes one more favorable than the other? Efficacy in treatment failure situations is important. Does the similarity mean that they're equivalent or interchangeable? Can we extrapolate that one from another agent? So because compliance is important to imatinib, is it important for the other ones? We think so, and we extrapolate that. changing the dosing strategies in various situations. So with CML, in the chronic phase, the lower doses. When they're in the accelerated phases, we use high doses, so doses matter. Is that dose worth it? Are the toxicities with going up in the dose really worth it? And these are all like theoretical questions. And compliance is also very important. If the patient's not getting the drug, it doesn't matter. So final remarks. User toxicity and survivorship. This is really important now, aside from talking about drugs in general. This is now talking about you guys. These are pharmacologically active agents that don't discern cancer cells necessarily from healthy cells. There is studies, lots and lots of studies, that show that these drugs have effects on healthcare workers. So pharmacists, nurses working in clinics, doctors handling these agents, researchers that handle these agents, they are not benign things, even at low, low levels. What they've discovered is low levels over long periods of time actually increase the risk of cancer over time. They increase the rate of miscarriages, birth defects, infertility. So both men and women should heed caution while receiving, while conceiving, pregnant or nursing. In clinical practice, agents should be handled in biological safety cabinets, and there are recommendations for those. Users should wear gowns, gloves, and in some cases, respirators. You should be familiar with OSHA and NIOSH standards for safe handling practices. Be an advocate for yourselves. Don't rely on the rules. Make sure that you understand why the rules are rules and see if there are other rules out there. And gloves, I'm a stickler about this. They should be ASTM tested for chemotherapy. So if you're handling chemotherapy in the lab, you should have gloves that protect against chemotherapy or have some data for them. One last word on toxicity, financial toxicity. A large percentage of drug development is in oncology, greater than 60%. Financial toxicity is a huge, huge buzzword in my field, in our field. Financial harm caused by patients accepting costly therapies. And so it's a question, are they warranted in their costs? Is the drug cost effective? These are questions that are being asked. Many agents cost several thousand each for each cycle and only add a few months of overall survival. That's a lot. And that's a lot when we have patients that can't afford it, when they're not even able to pay for health insurance. How are they going to pay for these drugs? Consider imatinib. We talked about imatinib as being this wonderful drug. It cost $5,000 a month 10 years ago when it was coming out. That's a little older than 10 years. Now it costs $10,000 for the same drug, same dose. Nothing's changed about the drug. The price did, though. We have immunotherapies, like the one Jimmy Carter's getting. It costs over $100,000 a year. Anti-nausea medications are about $1,000 for each cycle. Is this sustainable for patients, for the healthcare, the insurance companies, and for the hospitals? That's a really important question. So there is actually a proposed financial toxicity grading criteria. There it is. And that's that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. I guess I don't have my email up there. I suppose I should put it up there. If you do have any questions, if you're shy about asking them, if it's something that's not clear, I'd be happy to provide that to you.